All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and we're here today in the new Studio 1A. This studio is probably more like most people envision the old studio looked like, but this one is in an unfinished basement. But it's a nice space. I like it. It's sort of studio-y. And then maybe we put some books in here and some Jimi Hendrix posters or something. It'll be even more studio-like. So welcome to the studio audience here. I actually today I've done something I've never done before. And it was on purpose. I've been thinking about this podcast for quite some time, and I did not assemble a panel. The audience, I've given them just like always free rein to grab a mic if they feel so inclined. But they were unprepared. So I don't want you to hold their half-ass answers, against them if they give any. And the reason I didn't assemble, a panel on this one, was partly because of the topic and where it comes from. In the years, I think I first got really heavily involved online, in the ex-Mormon community in 2003. Well, I can't say ex-Mormon. That was in the liberal, apologetic, nom, all that sort of space. I actually attended church for the last time in the fall of 2005. By the time I had stopped attending church, I'd completely lost my faith. So there were a couple of years there where I wouldn't describe myself as a faithful member of the church, but I was trying to make it work. And that's why I can sometimes be really critical of those who are in the, in that space, because I tried it myself. I feel a kinship to trying to make it work without belief. And I ultimately don't think it works very well. It works for some, but I think it's a very hard path to walk. So one of the things that I found after we started recording the podcast, I know I've discussed this elsewhere, but it's a good foundation. One of the things I found is that in this chair, I'm privy to a lot of, pain, I guess is the best way to say it. Leaving the church is a very difficult thing to do. Leaving the church, that even begs the question. Having a crisis of faith is a very difficult thing to have happen to you. And you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So once you discover that the narrative that the church is telling you is not, factually represented, meaning you can't take the church at face value. Once you do a moderate level of research, you'll find that the church, whether you believe they're flat out fraudulent or somewhere in between, it's not the way it's been represented to you. And you have to renegotiate that. But for those who decide to leave the faith, or even those who decide to stay in, it's a very difficult transition to find a new self and find a new center. And that's what people are looking for. And they'll go through all the different stages. They'll go through anger, and they'll go through, they'll often become dicks for a while. And some of us stay there for a long, long, long time. It's a hard transition to make. There's not an easy answer to finding a faith that works for you. But what I've assembled here is my top 10 list, of recommendations or principles that I've observed in myself, that I've observed in many of the countless hundreds and hundreds of people that I've talked to or watched come out of the church in terms of finding a home, after leaving the faith, finding a new center, finding yourself and finding, peace and happiness and, all those great things that we're yearning for. So I've assembled this list of 10 ways to transition yourself out of the church. I think that's what I called it. With no further ado, let's start at the bottom of the list. Number 10, invest in yourself is the first principle. I think one of the things that religions do well, as an institution, and I shouldn't say religion, I should say maybe institutions, because we're talking about nationalism, we're talking about religion, we're talking about all these organizations and philosophies that the movements, mass movements, that's the word I'm using. They tend to focus on minimizing the self in order to pursue the greater. Whether that be, the Nazi party or it be, the Dominican order. you know, to go to polar opposites, that they tend to emphasize the fact that you as an individual are not very important. It's this greater thing that you're contributing to. And that provides a lot of sense of meaning, to get rid of oneself. I mean, we see that all the time in acts of giving and acts of love and acts of kindness in parenting, in brotherly love, in all those things where we minimize our own wants and needs for the wants and needs of others. Unfortunately, some of these mass movements take that and use it to means that are not good for humanity. And they will tend to manipulate you into believing that your sacrifice for whatever they ask, you know, obedience above all things to give yourself for the organization is the greater good. So the first principle I have here is when you're moving out of religion, to reverse that notion, and you are as an individual worth spending time on. You are as an individual worth investing in. You're worth going to school. You're worth taking up new skills. You're worth reading books. You're worth all of that. You're worth finding people who value you as a person. And that is a really hard thing for religious people to sometimes glom onto, especially, in our culture, women. Because women are trained in the church to just completely divest of the self. If you read LDS literature, everything they talk about women is all about the sacrifice of the individual for the group good. You're going to be a mother. You're going to be a wife. You're going to be a visiting teacher. You're going to be a Relief Society president. Everything is about this sacrifice. Now, for the men, oftentimes there's positions that have prestige and red chairs and stuff like that. But for the women, that's not so much the case. So invest in yourself. And these principles, I should say, are things that I think that help provide happiness and satisfaction over the long run. And I know I've said in the podcast before, and I believe firmly, that happiness is a spike. Happiness is not something that you can feel constantly. If you want a reason to reject all of religion altogether as being bogus, it's because they're all selling paradise. But paradise is not a state of being. It can never be that way. I don't care what you're doing. If you got caught in an endless orgasm for 10,000 years, you'd get tired of it.
Right. Prove it. I mean. Okay.
There's nothing. So ideally you're seeking for more just a level state of feeling peace, of feeling tranquility, of feeling satisfaction. And happiness is something that comes occasionally. So I think that investing in the self and knowing that you can do that, you can leave your kids at home and go do things that only you like to do. You can leave your spouse at home and you can spend money on yourself and you can better yourself. That's okay.
You know, one time back in the day, I have a memory of because I was involved pretty heavily with the Mormon Church, when I was part of that, my friends at work, they were always going on these amazing adventures, but, you know, I couldn't go because I had a meeting. And then when we stopped being Mormon, the whole world opened up to us and we all, and I just found that what I had missed out on all that time was awesome. So,
well, and I find that there's that awesomeness of experience, but that awesomeness of experience, be it whatever, be it taking a class or going river rafting, it recharges you. It makes you you will be a better mother if you spend one or two nights a week away from your husband, away from your kids. That's just the way it is. But the church ultimately is not looking for the best you. They're looking to get the most they can out of you.
They're looking for the best them.
Right,
they're
right.
They're trying to take everything from you so that they can build bigger churches, build bigger infrastructure, everything else. And, yeah, you end up losing yourself. You forget about yourself, whether it's time, money, and ultimately yourself, you end up losing yourself.
Indeed. Okay. Principle number nine. We're doing this in reverse order. So that was number 10. Number nine. Treat others like you would strangers. This is something I tell ex-Mormons all the time, because what happens is churches, fundamentalist churches like the LDS Church, have no boundaries, no personal boundaries. And I oftentimes tell people that when they're engaging, because they say, how do I engage all these Mormons that I work with? And I say, treat them like you would your Hindus. Like if your Hindu coworker was explaining to you some festival that he was going to, you might be a little patronizing. I mean, oh, that's so cute. Oh, that's so clever. But you wouldn't, like, go at them about the ninth avatar of Vishnu. You know, you wouldn't go there. You wouldn't look at them, hopefully, and say, how can you believe this? How can you be so ignorant? But oftentimes when people discover, and I think it's a natural thing, because you discover what you think is a fraud. You discover that everybody's involved in this thing that you see as a deception. And you really want to go out and proclaim the truth to the world. But as anybody's been a missionary knows that people who proclaim the truth are assholes. And you don't want to be one. So what you need to do is try to disengage from the church and treat it like a strange religion. Pretend you're an anthropologist. And over time, it will become more strange to you. After spans of 5 or 10 years out of the church, it won't affect you the same way. It'll just seem weird. You know? So as do other religions or other belief things that the people have. And having that healthy disengagement is really a valuable trick in maintaining good relationships. So I can sit next to a Sikh coworker and not make fun of him for his turban, just like I can sit next to my Mormon coworker and not make fun of him for his eternal smile. And I'm not even talking about out loud, I'm talking about in my head. Because if you're spending your time looking down on other people for believing this slop or whatever you have in your head, you're not going to be able to treat them as a decent, normal human being. So, and I think this is a great principle for family, also, which it's extremely difficult, because family will disengage quite a bit and those relationships get broken. But if you can give them the respect and deference you give a stranger, which is a polite smile, you don't tell them everything you're thinking about, you don't tell them exactly what you think is wrong with the way they're dressing, you give strangers all sorts of social deference that oftentimes you don't give people who are close to you. And I'm saying, as a matter of creating this peace bubble around you, if you can learn to do that, then you'll be better at establishing these relationships to a new norm, which has to happen. Every relationship that you have in your life when you leave the church gets reset. And that's relationships with people who were never members of the church, now, and people who were in the church. But sometimes those relationships were not real time or heart invested. So the more you have that, the more those relationships are going to be reset. But I don't care if you have a group of friends of 5 or 10 of you that all leave the church together, you're going to have to renegotiate over the next couple of years every single relationship, because you're all going to become new people. And being able to separate yourself from that will help guide through that. That's principle number 9. Principle number 8, live openly, authentically, and privately. I read these to the audience there before we started, and they're waiting to see how I'm going to resolve those three. But I think there is a way to live, and this kind of plays off of principle number 9, if you go to a Utah company, especially a very Mormon company, in the greater Salt Lake region, well, Salt Lake probably not, like Provo or whatever. Somebody who comes in from out of state, you know, just walks around with their mug of coffee, it means nothing to them, right? One way or the other. They're living openly. They're living authentically. They just like that. But they don't go around talking about coffee all the time. coffee is just, it's normal to have at work. So ex-Mormons have a problem of what we call promiscuous disclosure, which is the church has so long controlled everything about their private lives, their sexuality, You know, what words you can say, what thoughts you can think, where you can go, how you can dress yourself, what kind of jewelry you can wear, how much makeup you should wear, just every little aspect the church gets involved in. So oftentimes when people leave the church, their attitude is that, and they are going to let everybody know about everything in their life. And unfortunately, a lot of people are not ready to hear that. I was talking to some friends just recently about the first time I went to a party. When I was out of the church, wasn't the first party I went to, but the first time I saw somebody smoking pot, I was out of the church, but it freaked me out because I wasn't used to that. I hadn't contextualized it outside the church. I hadn't understood it. I hadn't processed it. And oftentimes that promiscuous disclosure by, ex-Mormons or is very scary to others who haven't, you know, even thought through that thing. It happens with alcohol. You know, we've joked about this quite a bit. It's actually no joke, but most Mormons can't tell the difference between alcohol consumption and alcohol addiction. They have no conceptualization of what somebody acts like when they've had one beer or what somebody acts like when they've had 10 drinks. And this was me. I'm describing myself at 30. All the knowledge I had about alcohol came from movies. And because I had never really even been to parties where people were drinking, I would leave the party once the alcohol came out. So I assumed that every party ended in an orgy. Maybe that's why ex-Mormon parties end in orgies, because they just assume that that's supposed to happen.
That's how it's
going to end. I'm at the wrong party.
And there's lions and tigers and.
So I'm saying live openly, meaning you don't have to. You don't have to cover up your bare shoulders. Live authentically to what you really believe, but live privately. And sometimes that means that if you're with your 90-year-old grandmother, you put a sweater on because you know she's going to freak out with the bare shoulders. That's okay. You don't have to push your belief down everybody else's throat. There is some catharsis in that. And in an appropriate situation, you know, going out to the Saturday farmer's market and, you know, in a sleeveless top can be a very important transition. And for most people, they would still say that's part of your private life. The way you dress yourself is part of your private life. But there is understanding society's boundaries and understanding appropriateness. You know, I don't wear my fetish garb when I go to the movies. I only wear that to the fetish parties because it's inappropriate, and you want to spring it out on everybody at the right time. It kind of ruins the moment if you just wear your latex all the time. Okay, number 7, and this one is sort of related to number 8, but I do want to dig into this a little bit deeper. Set healthy boundaries. This is extremely important, and this goes to number 9 also. So I like how these sort of interplay. And this is something you're going to have to do, I guarantee, with your family, unless they were converts. Because they will ask you questions that parents should not ask children. And your siblings will ask you questions. And your neighbors will ask you questions. And they will nose into, now everybody's nosy. Everybody gossips, whether you're in the church or outside the church. But you have to reset boundaries in the beginning. You usually won't have to do this with your coworkers or whatever, but sometimes you did. I know when I left the church, I had to reset healthy boundaries with coworkers who would ask me or imply or say things that were inappropriate. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's an uncomfortable thing to say. And sometimes I've answered my mother a few times, when she's asked questions. I said, I will answer that question if you really want me to. And usually at that point she backs down because she really doesn't want that answer. And you have to understand it's not that they're being dicks. They have social conditioning in a religious sort of fundamentalist group. You're supposed to be monitoring each other all the time and making sure nobody steps out of line. It's this lattice. And they've grown up in that just like you did. And they don't have those healthy boundaries either. So you have to establish those. You have to establish boundaries of privacy and knowing what is appropriate and what isn't. So if you can establish that bubble around yourself of that it's not appropriate just to come over at any time, that you have to call first, that it's not appropriate to ask me about my underwear. It's not appropriate to ask, you know, an adult what they do on a Friday or Saturday night. You know, there's these rules, and you have to just sort of say, That's private. That's between my husband and I. That's between my wives and I. And then they won't ask anymore.
I have that standing agreement with my mother that I've told her to not ask questions that she doesn't want to know the answers to. And she kind of steps back and rethinks if she wants to ask that question.
And you know, to that point, I talk like they're children, but in a lot of ways they are, and we were. They don't know. They don't know how to interact with the world. And I think a great example, when I actually came up with this, I was thinking about the dilemma of the coffee maker, which is what a lot of ex-Mormons go through. They'll go through these stages of ex-Mormonhood. And, you know, stage one is you have the coffee maker, but you hide it. Or you keep it out in the garage, you know, and then like how far you hide it, and then you put it on the counter, but you wouldn't make coffee around them so they don't have to smell it. And then at one point you don't give a So as you go through those phases, that's what I mean by this boundary keeping and by this living privately but openly, you know, that it's okay to have a coffee maker, and it's okay to have that coffee maker on your counter. That's an appropriate boundary, and it's an inappropriate boundary for them to say anything about it. Now, as we talked about a week or two ago, they won't really say anything about it. They'll be passive-aggressive about it. You know, sometimes you have to call them out on that, too.
That was a big thing for me at work. You know, as I started leaving the church, I started drinking my coffee. I liked my coffee, but I didn't want to take it into the office. I was like, oh, I can't say anything, can't show it.
Was that because you were working for the church at that time?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was, you know, just with other Mormon co-workers. And, I mean, there's a coffee pot in the office, and there's people that are drinking coffee, but they knew I was Mormon, you know, that I, as far as they knew, I was you know, attending, believing person. And then, you know, as time started progressing, it was a really big thing for me to, you know, say, yeah, I threw away an empty coffee cup.
Because you just leave it in your car.
In my trash. You know, and then I tell my wife, I brought a half a cup of coffee into the office and was drinking it while I was talking to a coworker, and he didn't say anything. Wow. You know, but I mean, you got to determine your boundaries with them, but also reset your internal boundaries and, you know, realize that it's okay. You know, it's all right that you're drinking coffee. Or, you know, another big one for me was I run with a guy, almost every day at lunchtime, and, you know, we're in a locker room. When I stopped wearing my garments, I kept wearing them for a long time because I didn't want to have to, you know, have that discussion. And, you know, finally I said, screw it, I'm not going to do it. And it was kind of a, you know, non-issue, but still, you know, finally realizing that you can live authentically, and it's not going to adversely affect some of your relationships sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and it might, but they need that schooling of boundaries anyway.
Yeah.
Because it might be that the relationship that you have when you establish boundaries with them gets damaged. But hopefully the next guy that comes along will be better for. I think the military commissioned a study, and I've seen this over and over again, The number one factor in acceptance of homosexuals is if they've had contact with a homosexual person. So in a lot of ways, when you go through the world trailblazing among Mormons and setting healthy boundaries, that will help them for the next time along. They will know what boundaries to have with people who are not of their faith. Okay, number six. Number six is quite simple. Go outside. The internet is a great and wonderful tool. And the problem is that a lot of us get, especially when we're in that first transitional phase out of the church, it's easy to get sucked into it and sucked into all these communities and this virtual friendship and this virtual fellowship. That being said, most of the friends that I have in this world, I met originally through these online communities, but then those relationships transition to real world relationships. And it's not, I'm not just talking about the internet, but the world is the place that we grew up in as a species. We evolved outside. And it's only a recent invention that, our houses aren't skanky little holes that we want to get out of. Literally, this is like the last 70 or 80 years. So they're air conditioned and spacious and comfortable with cozy chairs, and it's easy to spend a lot of time in them. And it's easy when you're in the church or something like that, to go back to our principle number 10, for them to use you in a way that has you doing those things all the time. And I think just one of the ways, remember, we're talking about ways to transition out of the church, to find yourself once you get out of the church, is to find yourself outside. And this could be anything from alpine skiing to going for a walk with your dog to going sightseeing. Just the world is this beautiful, wonderful, marvelous place as it is, without imposing any sort of religious existential meaning to it. And go out and enjoy it, because you're programmed to it. You will feel better. And there is something out there for you, some activity that you dig on. No matter your physical fitness status, no matter your athletic status or ability, there's something out there for you. And if you can get out of the damn house, you will start feeling better right away.
Even if it's just getting out onto the porch, you know, sitting out on the porch and all of a sudden realizing that, hey, you've got more than the four neighbors that, you know, corner your house. There's other people that are out walking their dogs. There's non-Mormons that live in your neighborhood and that, you know, you may live two houses down from you, but you've never seen them because you've never, you know, been in the same place on a Sunday.
Yes, for sure. And we'll talk about some other ways that of what you're saying. You're foreshadowing some of the things we're getting to. But there's a lot of excellent things you can do with people. But just, I'm just saying, even if you're alone, just being under the blue sky, here's my challenge to everybody before the next year. Go out in a rainstorm or a snowstorm. Not just for like 2 minutes to run to your, run to between Starbucks and your car, but go and spend some time out in the rain. And you'll first realize that it's cold and wet and that you really want to be inside. And then shortly after that, you'll realize that you're not dead yet. And then something magical might happen. And it might just be that your underwear gets wet. But you can get out there and experience all these things.
Assuming you're wearing underwear.
Good point.
Good.
Thanks for sharing that private information. All right. Number five.
Real.
And once again, we're talking about, just to reset, we're talking about ways of recovering from the church and really finding a new center. Because people are left feeling abandoned and lost. So these are ways that you can come to that. So find meaningful work, or find meaning in work. Oftentimes in an LDS paradigm or in a fundamentalist paradigm, I know some other religions like Jehovah's Witnesses are even worse for this. Work is just a means to get you through to the next LDS meeting or the next church meeting or the next calling or paying your tithing or whatever. And oftentimes people are called into callings before they can finish school. I know people who have been in graduate school and get pretty hefty callings like being bishops. And, you know, they say, well, this is more important in the long run. But meaningful work can, do a lot to establish your own sense of sort of peace in the world and your own sense of well-being. Now, before you think I'm going where I'm going. You'll see all these assholes who are interviewed on, like astronauts and pop stars who say the secret to whatever is do what you love. All right, dipshits. Most of us do not have the option of doing what we love. Like there's not that many Lady Gaga openings in the world. There's not that many astronauts, okay? So, and we do this, it's a fallacy, but you take successful people and you say, oh, look at this band. Look at Black Sabbath. They were so successful. How did you find the success you found? Well, a lot of sex, a lot of drugs, you know, that you can't take successful people and then backtrack their path to find out how they're successful, because you'll eliminate the 1,000 other people who did exactly the same thing but didn't make it. So I'm giving you a free pass to work a job that sucks, because work is work and they all suck. So what am I contradicting myself when I say meaningful work? Your work is not just your job. But it can be, and there's ways to find meaning in it. I've found that I've advanced through my career and done quite well for myself, partly because I was always willing to pick up and learn something new. And there's so many people who say, that's not my job description. That's not what I wanted to do. That's outside my comfort zone. I think finding meaning can be in pursuing excellence, pursuing the education, pursuing something different, or just something completely outside the work environment. It's okay to work 40 hours and then go home and do something else that gives you meaning. And that can be anything from working with animals to working with children. Well, I guess those are kind of the same thing. But it can be anything out there that can give you a sense of purpose in this world. And I'm emphasizing work here. And I would invite people, especially if they leave the church and they've lost that center, to just go out there and find it. There's so many things you can do. You can spend a night in a homeless shelter. You could spend a night in a homeless shelter, but you can work there. There's so many organizations looking for volunteers. And oftentimes you have to go out and make the job or make the world what you want, you know. Because sometimes you'll be like, hey, I'd like to do that, but they're so busy that you kind of have to go and say, here, let me take that on. Let me do the work and let me find the meaning there. So I think finding yourself meaningful work and going what I said about most jobs suck. You can find jobs that suck less than others, but sometimes it's on a larger time scale. That's okay. You know, if you have to start going back to school and it's going to take you 10 years to get where you want to be, 10 years are going to go by anyway. You know, and if that's what it takes, then that's what it takes. And you know, we live in a time, I'm 40 now, but reasonably, I have probably a good 35 years of work in front of me, you know, before I can retire with Social Security. That's a long time. You know, I could go back to medical school and graduate and still have a 25 year career as a doctor, right? I don't want to do that, but I could. And oftentimes we will make up all the reasons why we can't do things, why we can't find work that's meaningful. But really sometimes it's just that little tiny edge. And I can tell you, as somebody who hires people, the difference, oftentimes these little things make a difference, you know, between this person and that person. And getting those little things onto your resume or getting those experiences behind you can make all the difference in making work more meaningful and making work more rewarding. Okay, number four, invest in friends. Another thing that the church handicaps us about is we oftentimes do not understand how to make meaningful relationships. The relationships are artificially meaningful and shallow. If you don't believe this, move. You might have all these friends in the ward, move, and see how many of them will keep up with you. What will happen is somebody else will be put in that place, and that's where the relationship energy will be forced. And then there's no balance. And it's that way by design. And that way the church keeps the individual members sort of handicapped in relationship to social function. Because what the church does, as I've said before, is it takes everything away from you and then sells it back to you and then claims it as its own. And we are naturally social beings. That's the way we evolved. That's the way we function. If you take people away from social aspects, research has shown over and over again, it will severely damage them psychologically. It's not something that we just crave. It's something we absolutely have to have. It's a key factor of our mental health. And so the churches prey on that element. So what oftentimes happens is, because of that, when people are leaving the church, they've depended on the church for their entire social structure, their church and their family usually. And usually they have very few friends. They might have like one or two friends from high school, but they might be very separate in distance. And oftentimes, because the ward structure, it's interesting, because especially if you're in the Zion corridor, those people are really right on top of you. They can see your comings and goings. So what happens is you lose your entire social structure, which is why there's so many people, and there are quite a few, who leave the church and then go back, because they're so handicapped socially, they feel so lost. And then compounding with that internet problem of sitting in their dark basement just on the internet all the time and not even knowing where to go and how to make friends. Well, I hear that people say that when they leave the church saying, I don't even know how to make friends. And I remember when I was there and, you know, when we first left the church, that loneliness, that core loneliness that we felt, that got better over time as we learned to make friends. And we learn to build that social structure around us. So I use the word invest because that's what it takes. And you'll find, like a lot of investments, not all of them pay off, that you have to put energy into friendships. You have to invite people over. You have to give. And in a good relationship, there's reciprocity, meaning you give to them and they give to you, and there's a symbiotic back and forth that happens. If you sit back and wait for people to come into your life, that doesn't happen. And if you sit back and just hope, you know, somebody will ask you to dance, that doesn't happen unless you're already asking other people to dance. So you have to build that. You have to look at people as this potential relationship and put time and energy into it. And what that oftentimes means coming out of your comfort zone. And it means coming out of your comfort zone, because I'm telling you that the church has handicapped you on this front on purpose. But you are bigger than that, and you are better than that. And when you first start, it's going to feel very awkward. It's going to feel contrived. It's going to feel like, you're really presumptuous. But everybody feels that way, right? It's very rare as human beings when somebody approaches them to be like, how dare that person ask me about my day? What gives them the right? No, we're flattered by that. There are some great books out there on making friends, and I've read them. Go read one. And find some of those tips. There's things like come preloaded to any party with 5 questions you can ask anybody. And it's not like what animal would you be if you could be any animal. But there are legitimate questions and legitimate ways that you can connect with other people. But that connection with other people is so essential to having a sense of well-being and a sense of place in this world. Absolutely imperative. Okay. Number 3, find a hobby. And we talked about meaningful work, and I started talking about things where you're giving and contributing. A hobby can be completely selfish. And masturbation doesn't count. I'm taking that. That's just a given. You don't. You need to find another hobby besides porn, because oftentimes a good hobby is something that you're building something. You're increasing your skill set on some front. And badminton can be a hobby. Model railroads can be a hobby. Toll painting can be a hobby, but there's oftentimes this creative element or this element of increasing my skill. You know, even somebody who's been in a bowling league for 20 years is always looking, you know, to pick up one more pin, is always looking for a little bit of increase. And I would say there's a scale for good hobbies, and I'm completely talking out of my ass. I don't know anything about hobbies, but on the one side, the more alone you are with hobbies, the more creative it should be. Because that's going to, and the less creative it is, the more social it can be. Really all I want to do is make the point that hobbies can be both a social outlet to help find friends and help find, you know, the social aspect, as well as an aspect of growth and learning and becoming. So many people, because they've invested everything in the church, they don't have that. And I give you permission to try out 100 different hobbies before you find one that you like. And that's okay. It's okay to be a person that's always doing something new. And you may never land on anything that you like to do. And that's okay also. It's okay to have garage sales and sell your old equipment and everything.
And that kind of goes back to number 10 of investing in yourself. You know, there's no one sure investment. You've got to diversify, you've got to, you know, experiment in a lot of different things, and that's cool. I love going to the gym, and, you know, I actually do my gym workouts in a social environment, you know, where it's kind of a class type scenario. And so, you know, I am bettering myself, but then there's also the other people that you can kind of interact with and talk with and, you know, help build yourself up that way as well.
Yeah, and there's always a community. I don't care what your hobby is.
There's always somebody else doing it.
Yeah, yeah. There's always another. And with the online world, you can always connect with other people that way. And it gives you something to connect on other than either talking about the church or talking about the inverse of the church. You know, it gives you something else to focus on and start filling that space. Because that's why leaving the church is so hard. They say, oh, they can leave the church, they can't leave it alone. Because it filled up so much of what we were. And then you pop that balloon, and what you have is this big hole in yourself. And that needs to be filled with other things that are positive, ideally. Hobbies can be so diversified that, but the thing about it is it gives you satisfaction. It gives you happiness. And I guess maybe we should throw a bone to, it shouldn't be too destructive. I mean, you know, it should ultimately leave you better than, you know, but I'm not saying you could be in MMA and get the crap beaten out of you once every 6 months. But that's fine as long as you're not getting beat up too often. Let me throw a word out to, one of the problems with media and with everything that's accessible now is if you go online and let's use our model railroad example. If you go online and search for model railroads, you'll see these layouts or these models that have been set up by guys who've been doing this for 70 years and are just expert. And the problem is that mediocrity can scare us away from most everything. I am hereby giving you all permission to be mediocre. You know, I play on a softball team, and I'm a mediocre softball player. I play the bass guitar, and I'm a lousy bass guitar player. But I don't find the happiness that these things give me increases with my skill, right? I do like increasing my skill, but it doesn't make me any happier. Like when I've worked out in the gym and I look back at my logs and I see, oh, look, over the last year and a half, I've made a lot of progress. But it's not like now that I'm lifting, I was going to say twice as much, but who are we kidding? Now that I'm lifting 10 more pounds than I was 2 years ago, it's not like that lift gives me greater happiness. But the fact that I was able to increase it does give me happiness. So embrace fully your own mediocrity, because it's only through the forest of mediocrity that you do come to a skill set. And I would think that any really diversified person is going to have five or six things they do and things they do lousy. Sherlock Holmes plays the violin lousily, right? That's key.
Well, and I think you're your own worst critic. So if you find something that you like, the person that's going to be most critical is yourself, even if you are mediocre at something.
Right. If you're really scared of mediocrity, deliver your things to children. They don't care. Like
that's
if the,
what I
if
do.
The cupcake if the cupcake tastes good, then the kid's happy.
They just like their cool birthday cakes.
Yeah. Number two. So now we're getting down to the top two most important. Although I think all these things are important. Find yourself a social center. And friends are a key element to this, but I think it goes beyond friends. I think the number one thing that the secularists and the secular movement, the neo-atheists and all that, are missing is this social network that religions have co-opted. And this goes to my principle that religions take from us what is ours and sell it back to us. And people say in the church, I know I've said this before, people say that, oh, well, the church is perfect, the people aren't. And that is exactly backwards. The people are good. The people are what provides the church value. The church itself is a pile of shit.
Amen.
And the problem is that they do that. And that's part of the game they play is that the church is taking credit for all these great things the people are doing. And then when the system fails, it's because of the failures of men. But we need things more than just besties that we can drink with on a Friday night. I have lamented before that one of the biggest shames I see with my children growing up is they do not interact with elderly people at all. Because even as I have done work to try to build these social communities, it's still hard to get out of that generational thing. And one of the things that I grew up in a ward that had younger people and older people and middle-aged people, and that was a rich experience for me that I could interact with people who were of different generations. And we as a society are sort of failing on this front. And this goes to some of the principle I talked before about like finding a hobby. It is easy to find your own little community and just wrap yourself in it. And so we have to work it's not going to be handed to us. And I have had, oh, probably well over 1,000 ex-Mormons through my home, probably 2,000 or 3,000 in the years that I've been doing this. And I am amazed how many of them will give nothing back. They'll come and they will consume. And I'm happy. I don't buy drinks or buy snacks or whatever for people because I want something from them in return. But it is amazing how many people just vacuum through this world, go from one ex-Mormon group to another ex-Mormon group, just sucking everything up and never contributing anything back. And doing with such brazen, they will call and ask what you're doing and tell you, well, this other thing seems better, but they don't give. And every time you go to a party at somebody's house, I guarantee you the host has spent over $200 or $300 on ice, on plates, on all sorts of things. And they're doing it because they want to. I want to make that clear. But if you want to build a community that you want to be a part of, then you have to also give to that community. Not everybody has a home. Some of us live in townhouses and we can't have loud parties. But there are ways to contribute to the community, even in your own little way. And oftentimes this comes up in very subtle ways. And I don't mean to focus on the big example, people who have like larger social gatherings, because there's a lot of really great things. I've seen some amazing, amazing things happen out there in the ex-Mormon world that are completely unmotivated, because these are people who are nihilists, right? They're gonna die and that's all that's waiting for them. But they still do these great acts of kindness and these great acts of good. And I've had many phone calls of myself on a dark night by people who were smart enough to realize something was going on. And oftentimes by people who I don't necessarily invite over every Friday night, you know? And that's part of that social center and building that community. What I'm trying to say to you, I'm trying to shame you all a little bit into saying that you're needed desperately by somebody out there, even by people who aren't going to be your best friends. I just talked about the elderly. The other place we fail in our secular communities is the disenfranchised. This is why religions are still with us. There are people who are suffer on the Asperger's scale. There are people who are shut-ins. There are people who can't make it. There are people who don't drink. There are people who don't do all these sort of things, and they're shut out from the standard social activities. And religions are very, very good at reaching out to those people. I saw that we had in the VIP lounge last week. It was a little bit disheartening, I will admit. There was somebody who was obviously mentally handicapped, and they were from Britain, and they had joined the VIP lounge and were making posts in broken English. And the woman posted that she's getting baptized on Saturday. And the first post just went in with blood on their knives. They, just eviscerated her. And then there were enough people who said, well, wait a minute. This woman's actually, mentally handicapped. And then the thread turned into this sort of criticism of the church, that they were targeting the less fortunate, which is a valid argument. But at the same time, here you can see the joy from this woman, that she found a sense of community, that she found people who were reaching out to her, that she found friends. And so what I would challenge those who criticize the church, and I'm one of them. I mean, I'm calling myself out as a hypocrite here. The challenge the church for reaching out to those who are easy targets, we might call them, by missionaries. But what have the secular communities done for the same group? How many people who are, you know, socially incompetent or mentally handicapped do we invite to parties? Do we invite to our social gatherings? I don't see it happen very often. So we can criticize that, but we have to build that thing. Now, why is it on my list? Because building those sort of things, reaching out beyond just your besties and building that sort of community and contributing is going to give you that sense of peace, that sense of fulfillment, that sense of things that you lost. You know, a lot of people lament that they don't want to leave the church because of that, that bigger thing that they were part of, and that was legitimate. But the churches don't have a co-op on that. And we can build those in our own little ways. Now, I'm not saying everybody should go out and found a church or anything like that, but there are plenty of things out there that you can do that are already, the path has already been paved. And oftentimes it's as little as reaching out or talking to a neighbor, you know. And I can do tons better on this. I don't want you to think that I'm calling you out, because I can do so much more. Number one. I think the number one thing that we can all do, especially this is framed at sort of a lot of the people leave the church, end up in a secular worldview, where most of them are pretty agnostic when it boils right down to it. They're not planning on an afterlife. They're not planning on heavenly rewards, not planning on paradise. I think the number one thing that we can do to help build that happiness and build that satisfaction is learn to work on a time scale greater than your own. And I can't remember who I stole these words from. I searched for them. I think it might have been Hitchens. But it is easy in our capitalistic society that focuses on consumption, that focuses in on you identify yourself by wearing this brand or eating this food or going on this trip or, you know, being this sports fan. All of that is so transitory, and it's all going to be gone in not very long. But we have, if you think about something as simple as being able to read and write, in terms of, even in known history, it's like 10,000 years, what percentage of people who walked on this earth could write? It's a very, very small. And what do we do with that? What do we do with the fact that we can read? We read porn. We flirt with one another. I mean, we use it. We use it. You just read the articles. But here's this great gift that we've been given, and I'm really chastising myself because I have a very hard time writing. But there's so many things in my head that I want to say, and I think we have this ability to create above and beyond what is just going to be consumed. And if you read down my whole list from 10 to 2 again, they can all be wrapped up in this sort of thing, in these building things that outlast our own death. And I think that's something that can provide real satisfaction, because I will not live forever. And when I am gone, I am gone. And what I ate will go with me. And even like exercise and some of those things like that, I might forestall my own demise, but I'm not going to forestall it indefinitely. So I think that working on this greater timescale, we have the gift that has been given to us. For those of us in the United States, even those of us who might count ourselves as more poor, we have so many resources at our fingertip. You could, right now, get a block of marble and better tools than Michelangelo had, right? It's in your means. The only thing that's stopping you is your lack of imagination. You, with the internet today, and if you live in a fairly large city in the United States or moderate city, you can literally do anything, right? It's there. It's at your fingertips. And you can do things that will last and that will be there for generations to come. You have interesting things to say. You can write. You can create. You can build things in our society that have lasted longer. So while we're mortal, and we will pass along, and we will be forgotten inevitably, we can be part of things that go beyond us. We can be part of the development of ideas, the development of technologies, the development of art, the development of literature that can survive us. And even if your particular writing may not survive, it might inspire those that do, because we live in these long chains. So we have this beautiful opportunity, this humanity and evolution that seems to be spiraling upward, that we see greater complexity and the ability for just wonderful, amazing things, as well as dark things. When you look back at the 20th century, you see some of the greatest achievements of mankind, as well as some of the darkest chapters of our history. And you and I are on the edge of history. We're in a time with resources that have not been given to most. We have all been given a great gift. And I feel like I'm shaming people again. And the beauty of it is that if you work towards those ends, that can bring such satisfaction, that can bring such joy, that can bring such creative energy. And along those things, we start working on those time scales. We start working for communities, for example, that are going to survive us. That's why I have that social center separated from our friendships, because my friendship with Nathan is going to end. But the thing that Nathan and I build together, the community we build together, will survive either one of us. And the things that we write and the things that we say and the things that we record will survive us. And this is one of the reasons I think that, like, family and children, because you're working oftentimes on scales where you're pushing into the next generation and that can survive. Well, that can, raising kids can, and oftentimes is a masturbatory activity, right? It's just like you want them to reproduce whatever it is you do. But, so I'm not saying that you have to have kids to be on that scale, because there's better even ways to invest in that sort of thing. And that's probably one of the reasons I have this at number one. I think that's one of the hugest things we lose when we lose religion. We lose this idea that we're participating in something that's hugely beyond our own pettiness. That's hugely beyond our own materialism and our own small time scale. And it gives you this endurance. Like, you can stay in crappy relationships and live in crappy conditions. And as a matter of fact, I think that's one of the reasons that Christianity thrived in the Roman Empire, because it gave this underclass something to think about and something to live for. And made the downside of that is it made them more sort of accepting to what they have. So for you and I who've left the church, we don't have to accept anything anymore. But that gives us responsibility to build the world that we want to live in. It's not handed to you. There's no manual anymore like they gave you in the church. And that is a terrifying and beautiful thought, because you're free to do anything you want. And unfortunately, I spend much of that time with porn. So what are you going to do? You can't be on all the time. So that's my list of the 10 things. And once again, the list comes from my observation. I struggle with my own sense of happiness. I'll admit freely that I, from time to time in life, struggle with depression, like a lot of people do. Life can be really shitty sometimes. It's not all great. There's a reason I'm in Studio 1A Mark II, and it's not all happiness. But we can take what we have that's dealt to us, and we can try to make the world a better place. There have been countless times I have wished that the life that I had in terms of growing up in the church and then leaving the church had not been dealt to me. That I wish I would have either been one of those guys who could just stay in the church and love it and get satisfaction, or I would have had nothing to do with the motherfucker. But unfortunately, that's not a choice that I made. That this is sort of the lot that I drew in life. And the only thing I can do is do the best thing I can do with it. And I know the sort of things that make me happy. And being able to help other people and being able to put myself into a community and a sense of belonging and others around me and find that art, whatever that be, that creativeness, that these are the things that give me joy. So maybe the list is what I like to do. I like to go outside. I like to be creative. I like to build communities. And I hope that someday I can contribute something that will survive beyond my short years that I have left. But I think that turning away, although it's healthy to decompress, you need to process yourself out of the church. I don't think it's healthy just to suddenly turn it off one day and then ignore it all. You need to go and find out what happened there, how you got there, and help other people as you can, because there's so many coming behind you who are struggling the same way. But finding these new things, these new places to place your love, your attention, your time, your energy, I think will ultimately pay off. All right, any last words from you guys?
It's all true. Amen.
All right, well, as always, the discussion continues over at our website at mormonexpression.com. You can also join us on Facebook in the ever-growing VIP lounge, where you can find a lot of like-minded people and people that you'll love to hate. You can also plan on joining us in this fall. Let me find the date. Any of you guys have it on top of your head? You're all going to be there, right? Weekend of September 26th, we'll be taking the party bus from Salt Lake City to fabulous Las Vegas. You are all coming, aren't you?
Yep.
Epic.
Yeah, I saw that look. Yes, you will be coming. It will be epic. It'll be a lot of fun. It is a life-changing event, and not in the way you think it is. Not like you're going to have a lot of regrets. You're just going to meet a lot of great people and find your new family. And this I testify of. Right, Nate?
Amen.
Nate, you've been on every cruise, you've been on everything we've done, right?
I'm gonna figure it out one of these days.
So you get to hang out with Nate, who is an awesome dude. All right. Well, good night, everybody.
Night.
Thanks, Nate.